Bobby. Bobby, Alex, and Clarissa ate lunch together in a tiny compartment with electrical supplies stenciled on the door in four languages. It had a few unlabeled crates in it that they could use as tables and benches, so they'd taken to calling it the diner. The meal was the heavily spiced and deep-fried balls of bean paste that Belters called red kibble. On the side, they had a few bits of dried fruit and a thin seafood soup that tasted like the flavor came from having a fish swim through the broth.
"You know what I miss most about the Rosy about now?" Alex said, poking at his kibble, which rolled around his plate. "My ship knows how to make Martian food. I'm so sick of this Belter shit."
He was exaggerating his Mariner Valley drawl the way he always did when he spoke of the ship. Bobby laughed at him, then noisily drank off the last of her broth.
"It's good for you, boy," she said, mocking his drawl. "It keeps body and soul attached, and that's about the best I can say for it."
Clarissa smiled at their banter, but said nothing. She was picking up a single ball of kibble at a time, then carefully chewing it. It was like watching a bird eat in slow motion. "I wonder if the Laconians still eat Martian food," Bobby said. "We could ask." Alex tossed his plate down onto their crate table in disgust.
"You know, I think what chaps my ass more than anything else about this shit, the guys who came out of the gate and started wrecking our shit and taking over aren't some damn aliens. It's fucking Martians. I bet there are people on that Laconian ship I served with back in the day. Dollars to donuts, the top brass in the Marine detachment here are people you know, at least by name."
Bobby nodded, chewing the last of her kibble. "That's actually an interesting idea. I mean, could that be useful? Find some people in their command structure that know us? Is that an in?"
"I ain't talking about how it's useful, Bob," Alex said, nearly knocking over Clarissa's water glass with his angry hand gestures. "I'm talking about the idea that people just like us, Martian patriots, picked up and ran off with this Duarte guy and took about a third of the fleet with them."
"You ever wonder if it could have been us?" Bobby asked. Alex lowered his brows at her.
"You lost your mind?"
"No, really, think about it," Bobby said. "We were both out of the service when Duarte started making his move. You'd been retired for a decade at that point. I'd been out of the Corps for a couple of years. But if we'd still been active duty, could we have fallen for his pitch? I mean, a lot of good people did."
"A third of the stars of heaven," Clarissa said, as if she were agreeing.
Alex replied, cocking his head in confusion.
"A third of the what now, honey?" Bobby said.
"From the Bible, Revelation. When the devil fell from grace, he took a third of the angels with him. It's described as the great dragon pulling a third of the stars of heaven down with its tail."
"Huh," Alex said, like he had no idea what she was talking about.
"Why'd that pop into your head?" Bobby asked.
"Whatever story Duarte was selling was compelling enough to get a big chunk of the Martian military to buy in. The devil's story was freedom from the oppression of God's rules, and it was good enough to win a lot of angels to his side. Whatever Duarte's pitch was, it's a good one. Don't be so sure you wouldn't have bought it."
"Oh, I'm pretty fucking sure," Alex replied with a snort.
Bobby had to admit she wasn't. A galaxy-spanning human civilization run the way the Martians, at their best, ran things. Organized, focused on a single overarching goal. Efficient, well-planned, not wasting anything. She could see why that appealed to a lot of people when Mars was watching its dream of terraforming die. Duarte could step in and sell them a new dream that used all the same skills and attitudes that the old one had, but was even grander in scope. Bobby recognized that there was a version of her that was fighting on the Laconian side right now, and it made her itchy. Alex had started to gather up the plates and cups from their meal when Amos walked into the room.
"Hey, Babs, Cap wants to see us about that thing."
"Which thing?"
"The making sure no more bombs go off we don't know about thing."
"Oh, that thing. Be there in 5, she replied. And he shrugged and walked off without another word.
"Still kind of chafes, don't it?"
Alex said, his voice gentle.
"What?
Hearing him go back to calling Holden Cap?" Bobby said, ready to shrug it off. But something caught in her throat.
"Yeah, I gotta admit it does.
I might have a word with him on that."
"Be gentle," Clarissa said. "He's fragile right now."
Bobby had no idea what the word fragile meant when applied to Amos. She wasn't sure she wanted to learn. Saba leaned against one wall in the larger storage space that they'd been using as their insurgent cell meeting room. Someone had finally pushed all the crates and boxes up against the walls to serve as seating, and some enterprising thief on the crew had even managed to steal a few benches from one of the parks. About 20 members of their group were scattered around the space, including Holden, Naomi, and Amos. On the wall screen behind Saba was a diagram of Medina and a picture of a severe-looking woman with black hair and a lot of facial piercings. She stared at the camera with angry eyes, giving the picture a mugshot feel. The name Katria Mendez floated beneath her photo.
"The Voltaire Collective," Saba said, pointing at her. "Bomb throwers from ancient days."
"Fighters,"
someone in the room replied, making the word a term of respect.
"Ça bien,"
Saba replied.
"Now with Laconia, they go back to the old script. Apart from the fact that their strategy doesn't work anymore and it's fucking our shit up, they seem like people we want in our team," Holden said.
"We should recruit them. Coordinate with them. Killing them or feeding them to the Laconian should be our last option."
He sounded a little scattered, distracted. She wondered what was up with him.
He knew something or suspected something that was eating up all his spare cycles.
Bobby had seen it before.
Saba nodded with one fist. "If we can, we should."
He pointed to a sub-level on the Medina map marked Water Reclamation.
"Hold up here, then. I say we send our envoys to make them an offer of alliance."
Holden turned on his bench to look back at Bobby. She gave him a tiny nod. He stood up to take a spot next to Saba and said,
"I think we should send Bobby to speak for us. She can pass along our respects. Tell them we need to join up, and if they get belligerent, well, she can handle that, too."
"Agreed," Saba said.
"How many you want with you?"
"Let's keep this small," Bobby replied. "Just me and Amos for now. This should feel like natural allies reaching out, not a war party."
"Ça va bien," Saba said. "But this ends with they don't plant more bombs unless we say so. Our house gets an order now, one way or."
"Yeah," Bobby agreed. "One way or. That's where this ends."
The shortest path to water reclamation included a short jaunt through the inner drum. Bobby didn't mind. Hiding out with her resistance fighter buddies, including an awful lot of sleeping and eating in tiny metal rooms. Getting out into the habitat space with open air and a dirt floor and the full spectrum light on her face was a welcome change. Even the ubiquitous Laconians didn't ruin the mood. For the most part, their conquerors were easy to get along with. They acted like people who'd lived on Medina for years, eating in the restaurants, browsing the shops, making use of the entertainment districts. If you gave them a nod, they nodded back like old neighbors. Even the marine patrols moving past in their exotic blue power armor looked alert, but not particularly threatening. Bobby had seen the other version of them during the assassination attempt on the governor, so she knew they could go from friendly and professional to full rock and roll at the flip of a switch. Easy to get along with or not, the Laconians were a military occupation. You forgot that at your peril.
"How are you doing?"
Bobby asked as they walked through a particularly lush section of park. The lovingly tended path curved through grass, patches of flowers, and even past the occasional tree. Insects buzzed about, still the best-designed pollinating system there was. Technology did a lot of things well, but evolution had it beat when it came to environmental systems.
"My feet hurt," Amos said. "Kind of all the time now. Glad these belters keep the rotation at a third of a G."
"It's quicker to list the shit that doesn't hurt these days," Bobby said. "But that's not really what I meant."
"Yeah?"
Amos said. His tone didn't change at all, but Bobby had flown with him for a couple of decades now. She could hear the tension that had crept in.
"Claire thinks maybe you're having a tough time right now."
"Does she?"
Amos's voice had gone so flat it might have been a badly written computer simulation of him. He was checking out of the conversation. Pushing it farther wouldn't help.
"Anyway," Bobby said, keeping it light, "you need anything? I'm up for whatever."
"Yeah, I know, Babs," Amos said. "But these Voltaire guys are no joke. We better get our game faces on."
The Voltaire Collective occupied a dusty crawl space beneath and between half a dozen gigantic stainless steel tanks. It was a good spot. Unless the piping sprang a leak, there was literally no reason for anyone to come down to the space. The Collective definitely had some skill sets left over from their OPA resistance fighter days. Katria Mendez, in person, was all hard angles and sharp edges, and her dark eyes burned with a constant low-level fury. "You're actually coming here to lecture us on how to run an occupied insurgency?" she said. Her voice was gentle and warm, the voice of a favorite teacher or beloved aunt, a voice that asked if you wanted some lemonade with your cookies. It also had the precise diction and studied lack of accent that Bobby associated with advanced education. Her belter accent could have been measured in parts per billion.
"Not at all," Bobby started.
"Because," Katria continued, "the Collective has been a military branch of the OPA, resisting Inner Planet's control for nearly a century."
"I understand," Bobby said.
"Do you? Because it seems like you just showed up here and told us that we're not allowed to run any resistance operations without your consent. Or did I misunderstand what you were telling me?" Bobby heard shuffling feet behind her and turned around to see five members of Katria's cell had taken up a loose semicircle at her back. None of them held weapons in their hands, but they all wore the loose-fitting jumpsuits of the Medina Station maintenance workers. Lots of big pockets that could be hiding anything from a hammer to a compact machine pistol. Amos, standing to her left, caught her eye without losing his smile. He took a half-step back, managing to make it look casual.
"Look," Bobby said to Katria, stepping up and looking down at her from their half-meter height difference, "we didn't come here to start a fight. As far as I'm concerned, we're all on the same team. But if you force it to go the other way, we're prepared for that, too. And I promise you, it will not go the way you want."
"Honestly, I'm just not sure why Saba didn't come himself," Katria said, not backing down at all. "Or why he thought sending a Martian and an Earther to tell belters how to fight was the right message." Bobby didn't know any answer to that other than, "because we're the most intimidating soldiers he's got, now that walking through Medina with firearms has become a really bad idea." She winged it instead. Because maybe that is the message. Because this isn't about belters and inners and last century's bullshit. Because now it's about all of us versus the assholes who popped out of their gate 30 years into our game and decided they get to flip the table over. Katria nodded and smiled. That's actually not a terrible answer. Then let's ease down, Bobby said, taking a half step back to give Katria her space. Let's find a place to sit and have a drink and chat about how all of us can work together to fuck these Laconian assholes up. Yeah?
You keep giving me that eye, boy, and I'm gonna pull it out of your head and hand it back to you, Amos said,
his tone so mellow and conversational that it took Bobby a moment to recognize the threat was real. He was looking back at the semicircle of OPA toughs at their back, directing his empty gaze at them. But Bobby saw a vein of his temple throbbing like he was at risk of a stroke. The muscles moved under his skin like taut cable dragging over his jawbone. Amos, she said. And then she wasn't talking anymore because she was in a fight. Amos threw himself at someone behind her, and she heard grunts and the meaty thud of fists hitting flesh, but she couldn't turn around to see what was happening because a long knife had appeared in Katria's hand, and the woman was dancing toward her. Fighters, one of Saba's people had said. And, like the Laconians, the Voltaire Collective folks also seemed ready to go from 0 to 100 at the flip of a switch. Bobby didn't have time to dance with Katria, nor did she want to get herself stitched up from a knife fight, so she straight-kicked the woman in the diaphragm and dropped her to the deck with an explosive oof. She took a second to kick the knife away, then started to turn when something heavy slammed into her cheek. Through the explosion of stars in her vision, she saw Amos grappling with two men at the same time, choking one with his left arm while he slammed the second man into one of the water tanks over and over again with his right. A third man had climbed onto his back and was attempting a sleeper hold, but couldn't get his forearm under Amos's chin to lock it up. The other two OPA goons were flanking Bobby, and one of them was holding the crowbar he'd just cracked her cheekbone with. In the sort of slow-motion clarity Bobby always experienced during a fight, she saw skin and blood on the crowbar's edge. Oh, she thought, that's why my face feels wet. Crowbar was pulling back for another swing while his partner tried to get behind her. Bobby decided Crowbar was the more serious threat and lunged at him to get inside the arc of his swing. His arm went around her, and she felt the bar slam into her shoulder blade, which made her right arm go pins and needles numb. She threw a throat punch at him with it, and even though she couldn't feel it, her arm did what she told it to. Crowbar dropped his weapon and clutched his throat with both hands, gagging. His partner kicked her in the back twice. One kick hit her kidney and the other her butt. While the kidney shot might have her pissing blood for a few days, it was the kick to the ass that almost put her on the ground. It felt like someone set off a small bomb in her lower back, and she felt a sharp crack that almost certainly meant she'd snapped her tailbone. She turned to see him unleashing another kick, and managed to mostly sidestep it, letting it bounce off her hip and forcing him to stumble forward into her. She grabbed hold of his left arm and rotated through the hips to throw him face first into a pressure monitoring console a few feet away. He hit it with a thud and a crunch and started to sag. Then, just because he'd kicked her in the ass, she snapped his left arm before she let him drop. 5 minutes later, Katria and her five friends sat or lay on the floor, hands tied behind their backs. Amos had an eye that was already starting to swell shut, and four scrapes down his cheek that looked like he'd been clawed by a big cat. Bobby had carefully avoided looking at her own face in anything reflective. But based on the volume of blood in her shirt, the wound on her face had to be pretty grotesque. There goes my no-needing-stitches plan. The pain in her backside also meant she wasn't going to enjoy sitting for the next couple of months. That thought made her want to kick the unconscious man with a broken arm again. Or maybe Amos. Katria, Bobby said, leaning down over the Voltaire Collective cell leader. Is it okay if I call you Katria? If Katria had any objections, she kept them to herself. Great. So, look, this could have gone better. We kicked your ass, and you're pissed now. I get that. If you want to be part of the revolution, great. We'd love to have you. But you run all your ops through Saba's group. That's non-negotiable. Anything else, and we're killing you and hiding your bodies in the fertilizer recycling system. Bobby grabbed the front of Katria's shirt and picked her back up to her feet, then kept lifting until they were eye to eye. Do we understand each other? To her surprise, Katria laughed. There was a brightness in her eyes that looked like fever. We do indeed, the woman said. It could have been a sparring partner's salute, or the threat of retribution. Bobby really wished she could tell the difference. Chapter 27. Drummer. It was easy to forget sometimes that the void cities hadn't always been there. During the starving years, they'd been something like a dream, a promised land without the land. Homes for the belt that could move through the gates to whatever system they chose. There had been a magic to them then, a sense of the unprecedented. Time had worn that shine away. Drummer had spent more time in the last decade on people's home and independence and guardian than on ships or asteroid stations. They'd become so familiar that they'd bled back in her memory until it felt as though the corridors and chambers had been present since her childhood, even if she hadn't been on them. Like a city often mentioned, but not visited until adulthood, she had to remind herself that war was always this way. Had always been. Cities had been falling under siege since the time there were cities. Mortars had fallen on schools. Soldiers had stormed hospitals. Bombs had set churches and parks and children on fire. Homes had been lost before now. The tactical display floating over the table was off by orders of magnitude. If it had been to scale, Independence would have been too small to make out with a microscope. As it was, the identifying code was larger than the ship icon. A smear of light, smaller than a crumb of bread, that meant a city where 200,000 people, more or less, lived and worked, raised children, divorced and married, drank and danced and died. And then, burning sunward from it, the evacuation ships, even smaller, that carried as many people as would fit away from the theater of battle. She looked at them and saw all the other times children had been carried away from a disaster that was approaching and that could not be stopped. London, Beijing, Denver. History, she reminded herself, was peppered with moments like this one. It only felt different because this was her city, a void city, and this had never happened before. She had repurposed the central traffic control station of People's Home for this. Military analysts and engineers, some of them Union, most of them EMC, sat at the desks where civilians usually were. Feeds to the war rooms on Earth and Mars showed similar rooms with similar people, but considerably less light delay. The screens that usually listed incoming and outgoing ships with approach vectors and expected times were devoted to the incoming signals from all the active telescopy in the belt. Images of the major observation stations showed when fresh data streams were coming in, where they were coming from, when People's Home was transmitting. Images from Independence and the dozen EMC ships included flags for time delay, 1 hour and 23 minutes, and a composite of the enemy claimed the central display. Pale as a bone, burning lazily toward the point where the battle would begin. Maybe had begun. Maybe had started and ended in the 1 hour and 23 minutes it took light to bring the message to them. The resolution will get better as we get the signal bounce, the EMC technician said. She was younger than Drummer had been when she started working on Tycho, with red hair pulled back in a bun and a wide, doughy face. On Earth and Mars, other technicians were probably having the same conversations with the Prime Minister and Secretary General. It's a trade-off, of course, between immediacy of the direct signals and the better information density of delaying a few minutes to get the extra feeds. I just need to know what's happening, Drummer said. Avasarala, who still hadn't made the passage back to Earth, and Vaughn were at the edge of the room. Admiral Hu was at one of the central control consoles, sitting forward like an overeager schoolgirl at the first lecture of term. She'd come as a forward observer, the military leader of the EMC nearest to the battle without being in it. A bulb of what smelled like green tea rested on a side table Vaughn had brought out so that the Admiral wouldn't risk spilling on the control board. Drummer walked to her less because she wanted to talk than because she had to move. "Madam President," Hu said, nodding to her. "Admiral, odd being on the same side of a shooting war, isn't it? I never thought the day would come." "That says more about you than the reality of things," Drummer thought. The EMC wasn't its own side any more than Illis or Surabhi or Neue Ausland were. The dreams of empire faded slowly. It didn't matter. "We've got a comm report, Madam President." "Play it," Drummer snapped. The main screen shifted. The Laconian Admiral appeared. His voice was patient and calm, but there was a glitter in his eye, an excitement. It made Drummer's gut ache to see. "This is Admiral Trejo of the Heart of the Tempest to the approaching warships. I ask that you stand down. Any interference with our ship will be met in kind. Don't make this worse than it has to be." "Fuck you," Drummer said to the screen, but not softly enough that Admiral Hu didn't chuckle. It was only 10 seconds before the answer came. God, that's how close the distant warships all were to each other. Light seconds. Emily Santos Baca, the ranking board member who lived on Independence, her hair was pulled back in a tight braid in preparation for Null G, or it had been 1 hour and 23 minutes ago. "Admiral Trejo," Santos Baca said. "On behalf of the Transport Union and the Earth-Mars Coalition, I am informing you that your presence in Sol System is a violation of territorial space and is being considered an act of war. Your ship will break immediately and return to Laconia until appropriate contracts and diplomatic resolutions are in place." They were reports from two competing realities. Drummer wished that Santos Baca's sounded more plausible. The icons that marked the EMC ships were like dots drawn on the skin of a balloon, the Tempest moving in like a pin. It couldn't be long. Couldn't have been. "The dispersal," Hu said. "You see that? The way they're spread out? That's based on the Medina data your people sent. The spread of that magnetic, whatever the hell it was. We placed the ships so that no matter which one it aims at, it won't be able to get to. Good, eh?" "Excellent," Drummer said. Her throat was dry, but the smell of the tea was a little nauseating. "The range of it can't be good either," Hu said. "The science wonks say the power curve would be logarithmic. Remaining at range should force the bastards to use any other weapon systems they have. Assuming that the magnetic cannon even works in normal space. Because there's at least one idea that it's using special properties that only exist in the ring space. And if that's the case..." "Gloria," the old woman's voice was like a knife, "you're doing it again." Admiral Hu glanced back at Avasarala. Drummer hadn't heard her approach, but there she was. Her smile was indulgent and warm, and Drummer had to assume utterly false.
Gloria is a good warrior, but she gets chatty when she's nervous.
We're seeing fire, one of the analysts said. His voice was as calm and businesslike as a surgeon announcing a bleeder. The display shifted. The EMC ships and Independence were still there, but backgrounded as the focus changed to swarms of missiles pouring out toward the Tempest. Each one burned hard enough that a human body would have been pulped by the G-forces, and they barely seemed to move. The distances they traveled were vast. Even at their speed, 3 million clicks was a long time. Verbal threats that took seconds at light speed, followed by punches that would take minutes or hours. Even without the warheads, the kinetic force of the torpedoes would be massive, if they hit. The swarm crept forward, pixel by imperceptible pixel. Drummer waved a steward over and ordered a bulb of ice water and a bowl of hummus with bread. She had to try to eat. The hummus was half gone, and the tea tepid before the first of the missiles started winking out of existence. "What are we seeing, please?" Hu said. "It appears to be long-range PDCs," one of the analysts said. "We're waiting for the bounce feed so we can get higher resolution." Another 20 minutes, and a much sharper image of the Tempest appeared, with the timestamp to show it was just after the fleet's launch. All along the sides of the ship, tiny, dark eruptions like the spots on a shark. The PDC's housings appear to be covered by the hull. Telemetry from the Michael Souther is that the remaining missiles were redirected toward those structures. Were, an hour and 20 minutes ago. "They're not using their magnet beam," Hu said. "That's good. If it was cheap for them to fire it, they could use it to knock down missiles. If it's expensive to use, we may be able to exhaust it." Drummer thought that sounded like wishful thinking, but she didn't say so. She tried to take comfort in Hu's optimism. The data feeds shifted. More information coming in. The images of the Tempest sharpened. The PDCs came into clearer focus, but it didn't help Drummer understand them. The openings in the side of the ship looked like little mouths opening and closing, like the whole side of the ship was singing. There was no mechanism, she could see. She shuddered. The cloud of torpedoes was thinning. None of them would reach the body of the enemy ship. A bloom of glowing gas erupted from the Tempest's side, flinched, and then dissipated. "Railguns," an analyst said. The chatter of voices went into a higher gear. Tracking the railgun round, examining the spectrum of the plasma that had accompanied it, identifying the particular torpedo that it turned to dust. "Are there PDCs running low already?" Hu said to herself as much as anyone.
"It was a warning," Avasarala answered. "They're showing us that they have teeth and giving us the chance to back away."
"Maybe we should," Drummer said. No one replied. The markers for the EMC ships shifted like a school of fish moving together, and Independence with them. Their own volley of railguns, the slugs raining down from all directions. The Tempest had no way to stop them. All it could do was dodge. Drummer counted the minutes, watching the Tempest pull back and corkscrew out of the paths of danger, mostly.
"I'm seeing contact. 2 impacts on the starboard. Waiting for confirmation from Pallas and Luna, but I think we did them some damage."
The knot in Drummer's gut eased a little. If they could hurt it, they could kill it. It was just a question of scale and tactics. "The hull appears to be self-repairing."
"Matches the Medina battle," Hu said.
"Show me," Drummer barked, and the image on her screen shifted again. It was a fresh image, still fuzzy. The bone-pale skin of the Tempest rippled as the round struck it, and then again with a second strike. Waves passed through the ship like the surface of water. Nasty black and red welts glowed where the railgun rounds had hit, but the plating, or whatever it was, folded over the wound, closing it, then folded again, and the damage was gone as if it had never been there. Another volley of railgun fire from the EMC ships, but as the Tempest flinched back again and spun away again, it erupted in a cloud of plasma, and then emerged from it. Drummer didn't understand, until Who spoke. "Holy shit. How many railguns does that bastard have?" Now the Tempest shifted and swirled, leaving a trail of glowing gas behind it like an afterimage. It was beautiful in its way. A warrior's dance. Power and intention and technique that were almost balletic. And then the EMC ships began to die. "The Ontario is hit. Reporting reactor breach and dumping core. We are seeing impacts on the Severin, the Talwar, and the Odachi, but no system confirmation yet. Rounds arrived 30 seconds earlier than the model anticipated." "Fuckers," Avasarala said. "That's why they took out the missile. Throw a change up and let us think it was their fastball." "Whatever they're using for predictive algorithms, it's really good," Who said, awe in her voice. "That's almost a third of our attack group down, and if..." "Oh." For a moment, Drummer didn't understand what she was seeing. Independence, the second void city to launch, the home to hundreds of thousands, seemed to bloom like a flower. Long petals of carbon lace and titanium peeled back, turning as they did. Something terrible and bright happened in the center of the city. But Drummer couldn't guess what it was. What she knew, what mattered, was that between one breath and the next, Independence was dead. "We're counting 8 simultaneous impacts on the Void City," an analyst said from somewhere farther away than the control room. "They seem to have been placed to exploit resonance. We're seeing some structural breakdown." Emily Santos Baca was on the Independence, Drummer thought. She'd been dead already for over an hour. It didn't matter how much adrenaline was pumping through Drummer's veins, how tightly she gripped her bulb of old tea. She could shout the retreat order if she wanted to, but anyone in a position to hear her was dead already, or would be by the time her words could reach them. The PDCs along the Tempest side fluttered again. Another group of EMC torpedoes died, faster this time because it was a smaller attack. The Tempest seemed to pause, floating in the distant nothingness as if inviting the EMC ships to take their best shots, taunting them. An hour and 23 minutes before, the EMC ships shifted, lit their Epstein drives as hard as they'd go, and turned to whatever vector got them away from the theater of battle as quickly as they could. The Tempest didn't react. No new blooms from their railguns. No more torpedoes. Drummer didn't believe for a second that the enemy supplies had been exhausted. Trejo wasn't killing the other ships because he didn't need or want to. That was all. Drummer put her tea on the little side table next to Who's, turned, and walked out. She was aware in a vague, distant way of Vaughn behind her, calling her name. It wasn't something that mattered enough to attend to. The decking of people's home felt fragile under her feet, as if her footsteps might be enough to break them and spin her and everyone else in the city flying out into the vacuum. She passed her security detail. distantly aware of the men and women assigned to make sure she was safe in any circumstances, scrambling to follow her. It didn't matter, because they didn't matter. Not when a whole city could die in a heartbeat. She was in the lobby of the union's executive offices, sitting in an uncomfortable couch with her eyes locked on nothing in particular, when Avasarala found her. The old woman steered her wheelchair across from Drummer, like they were in someone's private quarters or a back porch back on Earth. There was no one else in the lobby. That was Vaughn's doing, more likely than not. In her imagination, the decking beneath her and Avasarala bucked and split open. What had Santos Baca thought when it happened? Had she had time to think about it at all? She was trying to understand that she would never see the younger woman again, but the thought wouldn't take. She dreaded what came after it did. "I'm sorry," Avasarala said. Drummer shook her head. "It won't help you," the old woman said, "but they all knew the risks going in. The chances that we would turn the tempest back the first time we tried? Always thin." "We should have waited," Drummer said. "We should have pulled them all back, gathered everyone together, and had every goddamn ship we have attack that fucking monstrosity at the same time. Wipe it out." Her voice broke. She was crying, but it didn't feel like it was her doing it. Avasarala handed her a cloth. "You're mistaken, Kamina. The cost was higher than we wanted, higher than we'd thought. But we did what we came here to do. Die? Badly?" "Learn," Avasarala said. "How quickly the deck healed itself? That's something we needed to know. But the places where a railgun round hit their PDCs, the weapon system there didn't grow right back into place. We needed those, too. And we didn't know to look for them. Maybe the ship can't fix more complex mechanisms. We have a map of the armaments now, where the PDCs are, where the railguns are, where the torpedoes launch from. Next time, you can target those specifically. Degrade its attacking power. Push it in ways we couldn't this time because we just didn't know." "All right," Drummer said. "They didn't die for nothing," Avasarala said. "Everyone dies for nothing," Drummer said. They were quiet for a moment. Drummer coughed, blew her nose into the cloth, and then leaned forward, her elbows on her knees. Since the moment she'd taken the oath of office, there had been moments, not many, but enough to recognize, that she'd been certain that her place at the head of the Union was all a terrible mistake. Saba promised her that everyone felt like that, like an imposter, sometimes. It was part of being human. His words had seemed comforting before. In her mind, independence died again. She had the sick feeling that it would die 1,000 more times before she got to sleep, more when she dreamed it. "Did you do this to me?" she asked. Avasarala frowned, papery forehead folding itself like a slept-on sheet. "Did you manipulate me into sacrificing my people so that you'd get the data you wanted?" Drummer said. "Was this you?" "This was history fucking us both," Avasarala said. "Live as long as I have. See the changes that I've seen. You'll learn something terrible about this. Tell me." "No point. Until you see it yourself, you won't understand." "Hey, you know what? Fuck you." Avasarala laughed hard enough that her wheelchair thought something was wrong and bucked forward a few centimeters before she could stop it. "Fair enough, Kamina. Fair enough. Here, then. See if you can follow me. Last long enough, and you'll see that they're all our people.
Independence and the Ontario, Drummer spat. Union and EMC, all one big happy family standing against the blowtorch together. Wonderful.
I told you that you wouldn't understand,
Avasarala said, her voice cold and cutting.
The fuckers on the Tempest? I'm telling you, they're us too.
Chapter 28. Holden. The artificially pretty man who acted as the news anchor for what everyone was calling the Laconian State news feed sat in somber reflection, not quite looking directly into the camera. On a screen behind him, the first battle between the Tempest and the combined forces of the Sol system played out. It was all from the Tempest's perspective, of course. Lots of telescopic zooms and torpedo guidance camera footage. In one, a Martian frigate, one of the Rocinante's next-generation cousins, died in a fireball as a railgun shot cut through it from nose to tail. In another, a torpedo camera POV hurtled through space and into the flank of a UNN destroyer and ended in a flash of static. One by one, the ships of the Sol fleet died. From the footage, it wasn't possible to tell if the Tempest was even damaged. And each time a ship died, a quiet gasp went through the air around Holden as he sat and watched the first act of the end of the world in a cramped metal room surrounded by the members of his little resistance group. The screen behind the pretty man went blank. He turned his sober face directly into the camera and said, "To address Medina Station, regarding what you've just seen, we are honored to bring you a statement from Station Governor Captain Santiago Singh." The camera pulled back to reveal Governor Singh sitting at the news desk next to a pretty boy. Singh lacked his counterpart's carefully sculpted androgynous beauty, but he shared his look of quiet reflection. "Greetings, Laconian citizens and residents of Medina Station. I come here in a moment of tragedy for us all. I will not gloat or brag about Laconian military superiority. I have no wish to glory in the destruction you've just witnessed. Instead, I honor the brave warriors of the Sol system who died believing they were defending their homes. There is no greater sacrifice a warrior can make, and I have nothing but respect for these courageous people. I ask that you honor them as well, as we have a moment of silence." Singh lowered his head and closed his eyes. Pretty Boy did the same. "Motherfucker," someone behind Holden said. Next to him, Bobby loudly cracked her knuckles and frowned so hard Holden worried she might pull out the fresh stitches holding her cheek together. On the screen, Singh lifted his head, then a moment later opened his eyes. "Laconians,
and I speak to everyone on Medina when I say that,
as I consider all of you my fellow citizens and peers. Laconians, the stated goal of your military is always the defense and protection of life. When the Sol system fleet ceased their attack and began a retreat, the heart of the Tempest immediately ceased firing on them. And no element of the Laconian military, ship, soldier, or station, will ever fire except in response to threat to life or property. Or in retribution against the whole fucking system you don't like," someone said from behind Holden. "Hypocritical Dawusa." Singh leaned forward, his dark eyes imploring all who watched him. "I urge everyone with family or friends in the Sol system to contact them, to urge their political representatives to meet with Admiral Trejo and discuss the terms of their entry into the Laconian Empire without further military action and loss of life. Those who died were heroes all. But Laconia
wants live citizens, not dead heroes. It is our duty, yours and mine, to do everything we can to achieve peace and safety for all of us. To this end, I am temporarily lifting the communication blackout back to the Sol system for those with family there. Please use this freedom to help your loved ones make the right decision. Thank you for your attention, and good day to all. Bobby rolled her shoulders like a boxer stepping into the ring. To her right, Naomi was staring at the screen through half-lidded eyes, like she was solving a complex math problem. Holden was about to speak when Saba stood up and walked to the front of the room. The 30 or so people of the Medina Station insurgency became respectfully quiet. Holden held his breath. "No reprisals," Saba said, and Holden released his held breath in a rush. That was not what he'd expected to hear.
"Usavi Koyos? Not one fucking thing."
"Yeah, pissed off you. Got reason. Got all the reason. Want to cut a throat, make somebody pay."
"Goddamn right,"
a skinny man everyone called Nutter said, standing up and toying with a knife on his belt.
"Maybe a lot of throats."
"You do," Saba said to him. "And yours is next. And I'm doing the cutting. Mushroom food, you.
Every Laconian throat you cut is 10 of ours you're bleeding out. We stay angry, but we stay smart, Sabi. Stay with your missions. Stay with your plans."
A ripple of grudging assent moved through the room. People started getting up to leave. The mutters of conversation had an edge to them. But Holden didn't hear anyone actively planning a murder, so he called it a win. Holden caught Bobby's eye and then stood up to grab Saba's arm before he could leave. "Let's talk." 15 minutes later, Saba, Bobby, and Naomi were sipping tea out of waxy cups in the diner. Holden tried casually leaning against the wall for a minute, then gave up and paced around the room to give his restless energy someplace to go. "The problem we've got right now is we're all rats in a cage," he said, "and we're spending a lot of time and energy figuring out how big the cage is and where the doors are and how we might open one. But we haven't got a single clue what we'd do if we actually got out."
"We don't start with just getting out?" Naomi asked.
"There was a time when I'd have said that was enough," Holden agreed. "But that was when I was still thinking of this as a war, when escaping to join up with our side of the fight might matter."
"This isn't a war now," Bobby said, her voice low and dangerous.
"No?" Saba asked.
"No," Holden said. "The war's over. Sol might not know it yet, and a lot of people will die so that they can feel like they gave it a shot, but it's over."
"So what then?" Saba asked.
"Good Laconians, us?"
"No," Holden replied. "At least, not yet. But it does change the nature of what we're doing here. We're not looking to get the Rosi free and join the fight. This is a jailbreak." Naomi made a clicking noise with her tongue, her eyes distant, then said,
"All the same problems. The Marines, the Laconian destroyer, Medina's scopes.
But you're saying if we can solve those, we just get as many people and ships free as we can and make a run for it. Scatter." Saba nodded one fist, then gave her the two-fingered OPA salute. Holden felt a little twinge of unease about that, but this wasn't the time to talk it through.
"It gives us a goal," Holden said. "Maybe we can keep everyone pulling the same direction if they understand what the endgame is."
Saba tilted his head. There was no surprise in his expression. He'd been thinking along the same lines, so maybe he'd come to the same conclusions.
"The decryption safe room.
I don't like losing it. Holden said, looking more at Bobby now than Saba. We're still getting in a lot of data from the sniffer, and I know once we move forward with the plan, we lose that. We won't get it back. But until we can decrypt what we do have, we can't use it. And the typhoon? It's due in 33 days. 32, Naomi said. I don't want to die with one still in the chamber, Bobby said. I'm good with the timing. Bien, Saba said. I mean... Great, Holden replied. Get word to every cell leader and ship captain you trust. We need to have everyone ready when the time comes. This is going to be some strange bedfellows, Saba said as he left. Find some lunch, Holden said to Naomi. Give me a half an hour, she replied. I want to get a computer crunching the tactical data that video gave us. But after that, meet out front? Okay, Holden said, wondering how to waste half an hour in the cramped space of their little hideout. Hey, Holden, Bobby said as Naomi left the room. Can I hang on to you for a second? Holden shrugged and sat in a crate. Bobby sat flexing her hands and staring at the floor so long that Holden started to wonder if he'd misheard her. He braced himself. He didn't know where this conversation was going to go, but he had a suspicion it was about her and him and the captaincy of the Rocinante. And he didn't know what to say about any of that, so it came as a kind of relief that he was wrong. Amos is going to be a problem, she finally said. I had the Voltaire people talked off the ledge when he started that fight. He wanted to crack some heads, and he made it happen. That's fine for shore leave when he wants to blow off some steam, but it won't fly when we're under the radar like this. Huh. Okay. I'd wondered about that. It's a problem I don't know how to fix, Bobby said. Me neither, Holden said. But give it a couple days. I'm not sure we have them, Bobby said. Why not? Bobby pointed behind her back, meaning not what was physically behind her, but backward in time. You just gave us all a goal, she said. Something to bring us all together. I did, Holden said. And I'm thinking, from the way you're looking at me right now, that there's some aspect of that I've maybe overlooked. Some of us are Katria Mendez and her mad bombers. Holden felt a coolness down his spine. Yeah, that could be interesting, he said. Right? He found Amos in a narrow side hall, a welding torch in his hand. The big man's arms showed little pocks of red where sparks had landed. But Amos hadn't done so much as find a long-sleeved work shirt. Hey, Holden said. How's it going? Doing all right, Amos said, gesturing at the conduits that textured the wall. Saba's folks said we should reroute the power. Makes it a little harder for the cops to track down where they're losing it from if it keeps moving. Yeah? Decent plan in theory, Amos said. In practice, kind of an ass pain, but whatever. I can see that, Holden said, then paused. The truth was, in spite of decades flying the same ship, Holden still had very little idea what made Amos tick. He liked food, booze, meaningless sex, jokes. He seemed to like palling around with Alex, but when their pilot had decided to try being married again, Bobby had been his best man. Amos treated every word out of Naomi's mouth as if it were gospel, but the truth was, all of them did these days. Amos found the conduit he was looking for, lit up the torch, and opened a 6-centimeter length of it, exposing the plastic-sheathed wire inside it without so much as melting the insulation. It was a good trick. Amos killed the torch. So, Holden said again, how's it going? Amos paused, turned to look at Holden. Ah, the big mechanic said.
Sorry there, Cap. Were we having a conversation and I didn't notice?
Kind of, yes, Holden said.
Babs ratted me out.
Amos's voice was as calm as the surface of still water. Holden was pretty certain something big was swimming underneath it.